Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. It is October 16th, 2016, the 14th day of Tishrei, 5777. In just a few hours, we will be bringing in the Sukkot holiday here in Israel. But despite that, and despite the rush and the fact that on every street corner now you see decorations being sold and lulavim and etrogim and tzchach for the sukkah and the last minute preparations for the holiday, I got Professor Gil Troy to agree to give me a few minutes to talk about the new article that he just put out, actually more of a paper, on the Jewish vote. So first of all, for those of you who are not familiar with him, Professor Gil Troy, maybe tell us a little bit about, just a little bit, because otherwise it will take too long, about what you do and why you wrote this paper.
Okay, good morning. My name is Gil Troy. I'm an American historian. I've been teaching for 20 years at McGill University. But 7 years ago, we went on sabbatical to Israel and haven't quite left. So we're here in Israel to be teaching this fall at the Ruderman Program in Haifa University on U.S. Jewry and Israeli Jewry. And in that context, I wrote a paper which has now become an ebook on the Jewish vote. And I've written lots of books about American presidential campaigning, including a book on the age of Clinton America in the 1990s. And I'm also a Jerusalem Post columnist.
And that's just the short version of what he does. And I guess the only thing, Gil, is that you didn't understand that sabbatical didn't mean 7 years. It meant the seventh year. And so, but we are so fortunate to have you here in Jerusalem. And I know for you as well, to have, as a former North American, as myself, an interesting perspective from both sides of the pond, as Jews, as, you know, people who care about the Jewish world and see things, though, now from more of a Middle Eastern perspective. So a little bit about, we're going into just like a few weeks before what looks to be a very interesting election in the United States. So what, tell us about the paper, your conclusions, your thoughts, because you are probably one of the experts, as you said, on American elections.
The paper looks at this whole phenomenon of the Jewish vote and says that there's a fundamental mistake that we usually make when we talk about the Jewish vote is we get involved in questions of Jewish power. How much influence are the Jews going to have over this election? And the truth is, Jews are only 2% of the population of the American population. Most of the story to me, which is more interesting, is a question of Jewish identity. How does the story of the Jewish vote, how does the story of how Jews see themselves, and particularly, how does the story of American Jews seeing not just themselves as liberal mostly, but seeing Judaism as liberal, what does that tell us about American Judaism and about Jewry in the world today?
So if I may ask you, can you please define liberal? Because the liberal, no, I know, I'm sorry if it sounds like a stupid question.
No, it's an excellent question.
Good. So let's start with that, because I think we bandy around that word a lot, what it means to be liberal. We all want to feel that we're liberal. Has that expression, has that term been taken to a place that it doesn't really mean? And particularly, as you said, when it comes to American Jews, or maybe Jews in general, who like to think of ourselves as what I used to understand as what liberal meant, which is tolerant to other people's opinions, you know, open to that. So please define liberal for us.
Okay, so first of all, Eve, your problem is you're too intelligent. Because
oh, thank you.
In a sense, you're working on the traditional definition of liberalism, which goes back to Thomas Jefferson, John Stuart Mill, and can include Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. Because if we look at the big picture of the world today and we compare Americans, Israelis, Westerners who love democracy, who love equality, who believe in justice, who believe in liberty, who believe in freedom, and compare them to Putin, compare them to ISIS, we're all liberals. Because basically the notion of liberal is the notion of one person, one vote, fundamental freedoms, and these freedoms inhering in the individual. But when we talk about liberalism in the modern world, we talk really about the divide between liberalism and conservatism. Great conservatives like Ronald Reagan were truly liberals too. So we're going to put that aside for the seminar on political science and political theory and go more practically. And in the modern world, in the American political context, when we talk about liberal versus conservative, we ultimately talk about liberals having more faith in the state to help achieve social justice and a certain overall sense of, beyond their faith in the state, a desire for a lot of personal autonomy when it comes to personal political decisions and social decisions. And we talk about conservatives being more skeptical about big government, but also wanting a certain culture that's more traditional, if that helps things.
I think that it does. And it doesn't really fit, I think, into what people would say. Let's say the Democratic Party is the liberal party, right? Most people would say right. that. And the Republicans are the conservatives. But what you just said doesn't really fit in how people think of those parties now.
Well, again, so, you know, Ronald Reagan was very careful to revere Thomas Jefferson and say, I'm a true liberal. He often always said, as a former Democrat, I didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me.
Yeah, I've heard quite a few Democrats say that. Yes.
If we zero in on, let's say, in 2016, a liberal, a Hillary Clinton liberal, defines him or herself as someone who truly believes in their autonomy when it comes to making all kinds of decisions about how they should express themselves sexually, what sexuality they should even have,
freedom of choice, let's say, when it comes to abortion, or something.
Right. And actually, in many ways, and one of the things I argue in the paper is that being pro-choice is one of the core values of what's considered to be modern liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And as skeptical as they are of government intruding on their personal lives, there's a contradiction because they also have far more faith than the average conservative in big government. So you have Hillary Clinton who wants government that's activist, wants government that's managing all kinds of things in the tax code and when it comes to building social justice, but also feels very strongly that the government should stay out of the bedroom, should stay out of the home. And you're right, there is an inherent contradiction. But the truth is, in America today, and in some ways in Israel today, most people know who's on the left and who's on the right, despite all the contradictions of the left and the right.
Mm-hmm. Although I think left and right, when it comes in Israel, you know, it manifests itself in different ways because we have these political issues with Arabs and peace and da-da-da.
Right. We have those issues, but we also there is still a certain kind of right-wing personality in Israel to be more traditional and a left-wing personality in Israel who tends to be more libertine. And you could say that similarly in the United States, there's a left-wing personality that tends to be much more open about their personal expressions, much more libertine, much more doubting about tradition. And conservatives tend to be more traditional, more family-oriented.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting for me, and I know for you as well, who stand in front of very different audiences, both conservative Jew, meaning small-c conservative Jews, let's say more traditional Jewish audiences, who tend to be like less pro-choice or things like that, the more, you know, religious people, but also very liberal Jews, let's say, you know, more reformed Jews, etc. Also, Christian audiences who tend to some degree, not understand the Jews who are so liberal in America. And it's a question that I get and that I know you get also. How does that fit with a Bible-loving people or with Judaism as they understand it, right? Which is a conservative small c, maybe, kind of religion, yet it sometimes seems that the Jews in North America are the most liberal of any population, not just vis-a-vis, you know, in a religious world, but like, you know, the most pro-choice, the most out there, even when compared to Hispanics or, you know, all the other kind of minorities in America. So what is your answer when you get this question in front of audiences?
So let's divide that into two. Let's first look at the American Jewish liberal. And there was a famous quote in 1973 by sociologist Milton Himmelfarb, who said that Jews earn like Episcopalians, but they vote like Puerto Ricans.
Right.
And what he basically meant was that American Jews, on the whole, tend to have extraordinary socioeconomic success and very high socioeconomic status. And yet, in their voting patterns, they tend to be more aligned with, at the time it was called Puerto Ricans, now we call them Hispanics, African Americans, now called the Tikkun Olam crowd. And in fact, it's true. Since the Reagan Revolution in 1980, people keep on predicting every 4 years that American Jews are going to start voting conservative. Not only has it not happened, but more American Jews are more liberal than ever. Liberalism is a central value of American Jewry, so much so that most American Jewish liberals will tell you, well, of course, because liberalism and Judaism are the same. Judaism is about tikkun olam. Now, what they miss...
Healing the world,
social justice, that's, you know, basically, they're what I call Isaians. They worship their interpretation of the prophet Isaiah, which is all about saving the world.
Helping the weak, those who can't help themselves. Right.
Using all kinds of personal power and also government power to harness it to help the unfortunate. And then that additional notion of personal, liberal, sexual freedom, being pro-choice, and being able to express yourself however you wish and act however you wish without government interference. That's become the fundamental defining tenet of 60 to 70% of the American Jewish community, as they have become less religious, as they've become less quote unquote traditionally Jewish, they have become even more committed to this notion of liberalism and this interpretation of liberalism equaling Judaism. What they miss is two fundamental contradictions. One, that in the United States of America, the more traditional you are as a Jew, the less likely you are to be liberal, mm-hmm. which raises questions about how does this liberalism-Judaism equation work. And secondly, when we look at Israel, we see that since 1977 and the Menachem Begin Revolution, there have been many more conservative governments in Israel than liberal governments. Although, of course, one of the things that makes it complicated is that Menachem Begin, and you could argue in some ways Bibi Netanyahu even, have a kind of liberal Jeffersonian streak in terms of believing in individual freedom and economic capitalism, but we'll put that aside. So the question becomes, what's going on? And this is the question that Christian audiences ask. And two things. First of all, I think when I speak to Christian audiences, the first thing I say is, sorry. I say that in Judaism, there's a notion of hakarat hatov, of acknowledging the good, of celebrating the good, of saying thank you for good works. And even if I may disagree with evangelical Christians on some of their social agenda, even if I may disagree with them on some of their political choices, I have to acknowledge that evangelical Christians have been ardent supporters of the state of Israel going back to the 1970s, and we should simply say thank you. Mm-hmm. And we have to be smart enough, shrewd enough, broad enough, every one of us as good-thinking Democrats, lowercase d, people who live in a democracy, to make alliances with people on all kinds of different things and not to say, well, if I disagree with you on one fundamental issue, therefore I'm not going to accept you on other issues. And the fact that we can have a big, broad, open, Abrahamic tent supporting Israel, a left-right tent, should include evangelicals, should include liberals, and we should say thank you to all those who support Israel. So that's my first answer to the Christians. My second answer is that indeed there is this split between, and it's a growing split, between Jews who define themselves as traditional, who tend to vote more conservative and more Republican, and Jews who define themselves as liberal, who vote liberal left in the Democratic Party, and also see themselves as living out a liberal left lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
their Judaism.
So I always have, I scratch my head and wonder when people who define themselves as liberal and tolerant and open-minded are upset with Israel. Like, you're a feminist and you're pro-Arab as opposed to being, you know, pro-Israel, where, you know, there are women everywhere on the Supreme Court and in the Knesset and the highest courts. We don't have to, like, ask somebody's permission to drive, for example, or to vote, which you have in the rest of the Middle East. So, you know, there is this, there's this inherent, I think, part of liberalism now in America that's somehow anti-Israel. Like, how did that happen?
Okay, sorry. So let's distinguish between mainstream American liberals who are still overwhelmingly pro-Israel.
Okay.
And my shorthand in my paper is I say, American Jews, let's even just talk about American Jews. American Jews in the voting booth are more pro-choice than pro-Israel. They're more motivated by their desires to vote on A, American issues, and B, on these issues of choice than about Israel. But it doesn't mean that they're not pro-Israel. It just doesn't
factor. It's not their priority.
It's not their priority, and it's not their core identity, especially when it comes to voting. What you're talking about is what I call the problem on the far left. That once upon a time, the far right in America was the home for the anti-Israel crazies. Mm-hmm. And in late 1980s, early 1990s, William F. Buckley, the great conservative, turned to Pat Buchanan, who was the great representative of these far-right crazies, and said, you don't belong in my Republican Party. The Republican Party doesn't have room for anti-Zionists who are essentially anti-Semites. Unfortunately, in the last 10, 20, 30 years, the far left of the Democratic Party and the far left of the universities have become home for the anti-Israel crazies. And I don't like to call opponents crazies, but as you point out, when you say you're feminist, and yet you can ignore the sexism in Saudi Arabia and the Palestinian territories. When you say you're against homophobia and you ignore the homophobia, the persecution against gays in the Palestinian territories and throughout the Arab world. When you say you're a lowercase d Democrat, you love democracy, and you can somehow excuse the autocracy of ISIS or Iran and or the murder that's going on in Syria, and you think the biggest issue is democratic Israel with all its flaws, then you're crazy. You're literally not following through on logic. And I'm sorry to say, as someone who loves universities, who is what
it's
I call
professor
a
of
I'm
university.
A professor. I call myself a pace of arrested development. I got to school as an undergraduate, loved it so much I never left.
There seems to be a theme here with you, Gil, by the way.
I don't want to change.
Yeah.
That our universities, which are supposed to be centers of free thought, of critical inquiry, of open-mindedness, of complexity, that we now have on our universities centers of anti-Israel hatred, of this irrationality, is really a national tragedy and a personal tragedy for me, and something I spend a lot of time fighting against.
Mm-hmm.
Professors can make anything complex. You know, that lovely ritual of buying Starbucks coffee. They can tell you stories about the history of coffee, about the history of the coffee bean, about
Juan Valdez, who used to be on the commercials when I was growing up. Yeah,
The economics of Starbucks turning a dollar commodity into $3.50, and the sociology feeling good about Starbucks. And yet, when it comes to Israel, all they can say is Israel apartheid or Zionism is racism.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't follow your core identity, when you break your core identity, and it comes to something about Jews, we call that bigotry. And that form of bigotry is called anti-Semitism. I hate sounding like my grandfather, Allah Shalom. I love my grandfather, but we disagreed about, I believe back in those days, that anti-Semitism was a thing of the past. He was right.
Yeah.
There is an ongoing anti-Semitism. When you see it's not just the inconsistency on the Israel issue, but it's the irrationality, the obsessiveness. When Israel becomes issue number one on certain American campuses, mm-hmm. when targeting Israel becomes more important than saving Syrians and fighting Iran and its nuclear agenda.
When Black Lives Matter becomes pro-Palestinian, like what does that have to do with anything?
And when my students at McGill University, I'm talking from personal discussions with who've had kids who have personal experience, are told, you cannot join the Feminist Alliance on campus. You cannot join the Gay Alliance on campus. You cannot join the Black Lives Matter on campus unless you check your Zionism at the door. That is something we are familiar with over, 3,000 years of suffering. That is called anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
And anti-Semitism among the most, quote-unquote, sophisticated progressive forces in the world today, in the university today, in America today, and we have to fight it. And
yeah.
We have to call on people like Barack Obama, like Bill Clinton, like Hillary Clinton, to call out the crazies in their party, just like William F. Buckley called out the crazies in his party.
So how do you think this is all going to be reflected in what's really a chaotic election season? I don't know any other word for it. In all you're a historian, so this is something that America now, 250 years of elections. How you wrote this report about the American Jewish vote, how are you seeing these elections right now? And how do you see American Jewry fitting in here? I mean, again, only 2% of the population, to get back to what you said initially, but somehow it's like a thing, the Jewish vote. So how's this all crystallizing here come November 2016?
So again, my take on the Jewish vote is that the story of the Jewish vote in 2016 as well is much more an internal story about what's going on within the Jewish community, what's our internal conversation, what's our identity, how do we see ourselves. I don't really think, especially in this election, and if the electoral polls right now are at all true and the gap between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump is growing greater and greater, the likelihood of the Jewish vote, even in swing states like Pennsylvania and Ohio, having a big impact is negligible. Where we do see the Jewish impact, though, is in the past 3 and 4 election cycles, over 50% of the individual contributions to Democrats have come from Jews.
That's amazing.
And over 25% of the individual contributions from Republicans have come from Jews. And so there still is a huge impact that way. And there is that megaphone effect where, because Jews live in Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, disproportionately, there's a bit of a megaphone effect. But to me, the real issue is this. There are two debates going on in the Jewish community. One, what does it mean to be pro-Israel? And we're seeing people who define Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton as anti-Israel. I think that's foolish and unsophisticated, because while Barack Obama has been hostile to the settlements and has been critical of Bibi Netanyahu, he also believes in the Jewish state. And I only use the phrase anti-Israel for those real crazies, those real extremes, fanatics, the Max Blumenthals, the Saudi Arabians, the Palestinian extremists who reject the Jewish state.
Although there are some people who will say that letting Iran off the hook and possibly letting Iran go nuclear wasn't a great thing for Israel's future.
I would say that being soft in Iran wasn't a great thing for the American future and for the Western future. And his foreign policy was a failure and has been a complete failure. And I say that as an American historian. Mm-hmm. But I don't call him anti-Israel. So there's a question of what does it mean to be pro-Israel, anti-Israel. Those people in the Jewish community who are so angry at Obama and so angry at Hillary Clinton, particularly on the settlements, or who simply say, and I know from anecdotal sources, some people say, I have a vote as an American living here in Israel. I don't really care about anything but the settlements. I'm voting for the settlements. I think that Donald Trump will be the most ardent supporter of the settlements. Therefore, I'm voting for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I've been, I think, scoring points with the right because I've been critical of the left. Let me score some points with the left by being critical of the right. I think that someone who looks at Donald Trump and doesn't take what we traditionally call midot, call a question of musar, call questions of ethics, mm-hmm. of standards,
morality,
and morality, and doesn't apply that to Donald Trump, and doesn't say, what is the impact of a candidate who speaks so disrespectfully of women, who speaks so disrespectfully of Mexicans, who speaks so disrespectfully of Muslims, who speaks so disrespectfully of so many different quarters of the community? What kind of leader could he be? What kind of demagoguery is he playing? What kind of morality is he advancing? Mm-hmm. Who doesn't? If you don't ask those questions, then I don't think you're really assessing the full impact of the American political situation today and the full impact of the sociological situation in America today. And I'm troubled by people who simply say I'm a one-issue voter. I don't think that's loyal to the United States of America, and I don't think that's the kind of voter that the founding fathers were looking for. And so I look at people on the right and I say to them, beware what you wish for.
Right.
Don't vote for someone who has shown, I'm sorry to say, monstrous abilities, mm-hmm. and monstrous tendencies and an inability to be stable. How do you know that tomorrow he won't wake up and decide the Jews are against him or the Israelis are against him, and or decide that he's the great deal maker and the best deal going is to impose some kind of ridiculous breakthrough of the stalemate between Palestinians and Israelis that don't work to your advantage?
Right.
The man has never served in public office. The man is not stable. He has no track record. Now, on the other hand, I look at Hillary Clinton. I see the astonishingly bad judgment when it comes to emails. I see that on the Israel issue, there are what I call three Hillary Clintons in the race. There's the Hillary Clinton from the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, who was somewhat critical of Israel, who didn't have the same love for the country that Bill Clinton had, who was more part of that new left that looked at the Palestinians as blacks, a false analogy which insults Palestinians and insults blacks and is very, very toxic. That's Hillary number one. Hillary number two is the Hillary who was senator from what state was that? Oh, yes, New York, which has a certain number of Jews, if you want to talk about
a few, one or two.
And all of a sudden, she was a big cheerleader for Israel. To put it less cynically, she also was senator during 9/11 and saw the impact of terrorism on her home state and felt the power of terrorism and was sympathetic to Israel, who was going through that awful terrorism at the time. That's Hillary number two. Hillary number three is the Hillary who was the Secretary of State to Barack Obama, who boasts in her memoir of being the designated yeller against Bibi Netanyahu and put a lot of pressure on Bibi Netanyahu, mm-hmm. and Israel in the settlements. So in the current election, Hillary Clinton, when she speaks to Jewish groups, basically says Hillary 2 is running. Hillary number 2 is the one who turns to Chaim Saban and says, I'm going to stand by the Jewish state and I am going to do everything I can. And so Chaim Saban, who is an ardent pro-Israel patriot, although and a Democrat, right. has given over $6.5 million to the Hillary Clinton campaign. The fear is that Hillary Clinton might bring in the old, tired Bill Clinton peace processors, the ones who have the same map in their head and the same ideas in their head that Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin started with in the 1990s, and somehow missed the fact that most Palestinians didn't accept it,
right.
and that the failure of the Oslo peace process came from the fact that Israelis were ready to move, to be more compromising, to give back lots of territory, to give Palestinians lots of autonomy, and most of the Palestinian leadership at the time wasn't willing to accept the Jewish state.
Mm-hmm.
We're fighting 1967, debating what boundaries should there be, and too many Palestinians are still fighting 1948, imagining that they can wipe out the Jewish state. The day that the Palestinians shift and start fighting the 67 war rather than the 48 war. The day they start saying, okay, let's debate boundaries and borders, we accept your right. They don't target my kids and your kids. They don't target me and you as evil settlers. And by the way, we learned in the second, I don't like to use the word intifada because that's their word, right. In the second wave of terrorism, triggered by Oslo, that to them, Tel Aviv is a settlement, and Hadera is a settlement, and Haifa is a settlement, and every village in Israel from north to south, from east to west is a settlement. The day they stop doing that, there's a shot at peace. But as long as they delegitimize Israel, as long as just last week we see them pushing an absurd, insulting, ugh, idiotic resolution in UNESCO that says that the Temple Mount is only Muslim property and wipes out the Jews from the historical record, it suggests that they want to wipe out the Jews from the current real record, and there's no basis for peace.
So you're afraid Hillary Clinton might be still reading from that particular script and using government in order to push through something that the little people don't, on either side, don't want. It's not dealing with reality. Right. And I think if you brought up morality, there's also a persistent question of her corruption or perhaps doing things for the wrong reasons. That's kind of seems to be a theme running through as well. What do you think about that?
You know, here's what I think. I think that if we could do a soul scan,
yeah,
of Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, and Hillary Clinton, I think Hillary Clinton is probably the most honest, the least corrupt. I think she's also the worst liar of the three of them. And as a result, she conveys this discomfort when she goes into that lying zone. I mean, Bill Clinton can lock eyes with you.
He's a great liar.
And he's a great liar because he really believes in the moment what he's saying. Donald Trump is a great liar because he really believes in the bigger picture. And frankly, we should give Donald Trump credit. One of the reasons why Donald Trump has been so successful is because there are a lot of lies in America today. There's a lot of political correctness on the American campus and the American government today that doesn't acknowledge the truth. And when the president of the United States can't use the phrase Islamic radicalism,
right,
when the former Secretary of State has difficulty using the phrase Islamic radicalism, Donald Trump, who uses that phrase, which, because it's a real phenomenon, comes across as a truth teller and can therefore make other bold-faced lies and be abusive in other ways because he is being true in that way.
So everybody's picking how they're going to lie and when they're going to tell the truth. Lovely.
So my job here is not to endorse one candidate or the other.
Yeah.
My job here is to say simply, don't just be moralistic about Hillary Clinton, be moralistic about Donald Trump as well. My job here is to say, don't just be moralistic about Donald Trump's abusive, disgusting, vile comments and behavior towards women. Don't forget how Bill Clinton treated women when he was president. And I have to say, as someone who was called a conservative, which in the university, of course, is the ugliest, dirtiest word you can call somebody in the 1990s, when I called out Bill Clinton for his immorality, now when I see the same people who enabled Bill Clinton's immorality toward women being so sanctimonious and so self-righteous about Donald Trump's piggishness, I go, what's going on? And similarly, when I look to the right and I see Republicans who held Bill Clinton to a high moral standard with women in the 1990s, now somewhat excusing Donald Trump's boorishness, I go, what's going on? I'm sick and tired of the hypocrisy. Yes, elections are about difficult choices. You have to choose Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, ultimately, as an American today. That doesn't mean you have to revere them so much that you can't see their faults.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that you have to forget that you ultimately have to be at peace with yourself and have some sense of consistency.
You know, I think it gets almost biblical here in the sense that the Bible is such an interesting book because it points out everybody's flaws. I mean, one of the central themes of the Bible is that the kings were all insanely human, all right? And yes, we're not supposed to deify them, and the Bible makes very sure that we won't, okay? Because everybody's, you know, peccadilloes are right out there. And here you have an election season where it's all in our faces. I mean, there is no way that you can think that any of the candidates is like somebody you would necessarily want in your family, but this is one of the two is going to have to sit at the head of the world superpower, or, you know, hopefully will stay the world superpower in the coming months.
And it's not just the kings, it's our founding fathers.
Right? Yes.
Abraham was flawed.
Everybody.
So the way I put this in American political terms is the late, great mayor of New York, Ed Koch, said, if you agree with me on 7 of 12 things, please vote for me. If you agree with me on 12 of 12, if you agree with me on 12 of 12 things, please see a psychiatrist. And And that's basically my message to the American voter, to the American Jewish voter, to the Israeli American Jewish voter. You don't need full consistency, but at the end of the day, you have to make a mature voice. You have to make a mature vote. You have to make a balanced choice, asking yourself, who is the most reliable choice in this election of terrible choices?
Yeah.
To handle the nuclear file, to handle the economics, to handle the Israel-Palestinian file, to handle the moral future of the American people, to handle the unity of a very divided country.
Right.
And and we have to hope that 4 years from now, we'll have better choices.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we all agree. Just tell me, Professor Gilchoy, if somebody wants to get to read the report that you wrote about the American Jewish vote, will you send it to them? Is it available anywhere?
Well, fortunately,
online?
It's available on ebook. So
great.
You can just look for Gilchoy, the Jewish vote. You can also, once we're plugging, look for my book, The Age of Clinton, America in the 1990s. And you can also look for my book, Moynihan's Moment on America's Fight Against Zionism's Racism, because these are the issues we can talk about today. It looks at the history of anti-Zionism and that great moment in 1975 when one liberal Irish Catholic stood up, an academic stood up and said, this is ridiculous. Zionism is not racism. In fact, Zionism is the least racist form of nationalism in the United Nations because Jews are both a people and a religion. You can convert into Judaism and therefore become part of the Jewish people, which means we're not biologically based. And so he embraced the Jewish people. He embraced Israel. He embraced Zionism, as we should all. Thank you very much.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you one last question, which isn't fair because you're a historian, not a prophet. But how do you see when historians write about what's going on right now, you know, in the world, in America specifically, because the American elections are a culmination of a whole lot of other things going on. I mean, these two are not the candidates just by happenstance. There's a whole process that's led to this. Any ideas how you are going to, in a year, two, four, ten, look back and try and make some sense? Or that's just an impossible question to answer, because like I said, prophecy is only given to fools, and Gilchoy, you're far from being a fool.
Thank you. Kind of you to say. It's normally a difficult question, but I do think what we can say is that every election is a stress test. It's kind of like, you know, those tests where you start, where you see how hard and well your heart rate is working. And I think that regardless of the outcome, when we see how much ugliness has emerged in this campaign,
right,
when we see how flawed these two candidates have been, we can really say that so far the United States in 2016 is failing the stress test. And that doesn't mean that in 2017 we won't have a turnaround and we'll be able to say, wow, we went through a terrible election and we were able to emerge from it.
Mm-hmm.
But right now at this moment, when we see the ugliness on the streets, when we see the anger, when we see the dismay, when we see the demoralization, when we see that America has really become America that used to become a republic of something has become a republic of nothing. What do we stand for? Who are we? We're lost. We can really say that, unfortunately, 8 years of Barack Obama have produced this soul sickness, this search for who are we. We're seeing it from the left. We're seeing it. Do you know that Americans under the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, black and white, had more faith in race relations than they do under the Obama administration?
Wow.
Something has gone terribly wrong here. And the 2016 election is a referendum on Obama's presidency, saying in certain key ways he failed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a referendum on where we're at right now. And we're saying we're failing the social stress test, this political stress test, this economic stress test. And all I can say is that for all our concern right now, the United States of America is a remarkably resilient country, like Israel. Democracy is a remarkably resilient form of government for all its flaws. And for all my worries right now, in October 2016, my long-term focus is my long-term faith in America and in Israel and in the West and in democracies is not yet shattered and is not yet shaken. I still believe.
Okay. So from your mouth to God's ears, I think we can all agree with that. And hope that when we look back, we'll see that this is really the low point and that America was able to pull itself out of this and be the great country that we both believe that she is and can be, and the true friend to Israel as well. Thank you so much, Professor Gilchoy. And let you go to your Sukkot. All right, everybody. This is Eve Harrow Rejuvenation. Don't go away. I'm going to be back in just a couple of minutes and give you just a wrap-up for today's show. So be right back. Thanks so much. Hi, this is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. You can hear a new show from me every Sunday and every day of the week, shows from another one of my very talented fellow show hosts. Reach me, Eve, at thelandofisrael.com, and keep listening, everybody. We love your feedback. The Land of Israel, coming at you every day, every week. That's the Land of Israel Network on thelandofisrael.com. Hey everyone, just wanted to leave you with a couple of thoughts about Sukkot, about tabernacles, about the beautiful holiday that when you're in Israel is all over you. It is a national holiday for the next week. We are going, if you drive around Israel now, you see a little sukkah, you see a little booth like hanging off of every porch almost, and like in the little backyards and on the sidewalks, and you really feel the holiday. People are bustling around buying the lulav, buying the palm frond, buying the etrog, cooking for the holiday, getting ready to pray for rain at the end of the holiday, because now we're going to be starting, hopefully, our rainy season. This is also how we see that God loves us, by providing us with rain as the farmers get out there and start to plant and, sow for the season that then we can have next summer, next spring and next summer, have the food. So just a couple of suggestions. One is, even if you're not in Israel, or even if you are, eat some dates. This is the date harvest, and we feel that so tremendously here, and I'm going to be going down to the Jordan Valley with people. I'm working hard during the intermediate days of Sukkot, guiding people around Israel, but want to always get under those palm trees, see where the schach came from, the palm fronds, understand that it's now the date harvest season, connect once again, another holiday. Just doesn't go away. Connect another holiday with the land of Israel and the rhythm of the land of Israel and the bounty of the food that God gives us here. So if you are in Israel and you have a day free, I will not be guiding those 2 days. I've got other commitments. But One Israel Fund on Wednesday and on Thursday has 2 day trips. And there are still places available on those buses. So you can go to the website, the One Israel Fund website, and still sign up for those trips. And just like to kind of put it together with some of the really very important thoughts that Professor Giltroy was giving us during this season. You know, if we did have a temple and if we were able to go, because Sukkot is one of the three pilgrimage holidays where we would go with the harvest, we would go with our families here at the end of the, you know, the summer, the beginning again of the rainy season, the end of the dry season, we would go to the temple. The absurdity of the world denying just a few days before Sukkot that the Jews have any connection with the Temple Mount. It just tells you that, you know, when I ran into Giltroy a couple of days ago at a wedding, and that's where I, you know, asked him to come on the show. And one of the things that he said to me when he saw me, he said, hi, he said, you know, you don't have to write fiction anymore, because nonfiction, or what's happening in the world today, is like science, you know, it's like the crazy, it's crazier than anything you could make up. And so I think when we all, whether we pray or we don't pray, or we think about this, you know, again, transitional season, and we should think mainly that truths should reside once again somewhere in this world. Okay, you know, we talk about the American elections, and we see that politics does not bring out people who really tell the truth as we would like to hear it, maybe for political expediency, or so that they can vote, so that they can get, you know, someone to donate to them. They'll say what they think the audience wants to hear. But is that what we want to hear? Is that really what we want to hear? Do we want to hear truth? And with that, I just want to interject something a little more personal. I get mail. I love getting mail, by the way. One of the problems with radio is it's just this one way. I love hearing feedback from my listeners. But some of the feedback from my listeners are along the lines of, I am not going to listen to your show anymore because I didn't like the interview that you did, whenever you did it. I don't think that Kabbalah has any importance. I don't think that mystical Judaism has any importance. I don't want to hear a person talking about that. I don't want to hear that you interviewed somebody who talked about the fact that perhaps there wasn't prayer the way we know it in the temple. So we are putting out double messages in that case. On the one hand, we are saying, we want to hear truth. We want to hear what people have to say, their truth. Okay, we want to hear people's opinions. We want to be tolerant. One of the things that's bothering so many of us about the so-called liberal left is that they're not willing to hear any other opinions. You talk about the campuses, right? Unless you specifically believe in one certain line, you have no place for your opinion. Is that the world the way we really want it? We only want to hear the things that make us comfortable, that fit in with our worldview. It's okay to hear things that you don't believe in. It's okay to hear opinions that you don't necessarily share. And if any of you think that this show is always going to fit with your worldview, then you might have to change your dial or whatever it is that people do on the internet. I am not going to only interview people that I agree with. Okay, many of the people that I will interview here, I don't necessarily agree with what they have to say, but I think it's important for me to provide a platform for all of us to think about other ideas. You can come to the conclusion that you don't agree with that person and you're down, you're okay with the way you felt before. That's fine. But if there's no thinking process, if there's no sometimes stepping out of your comfort zone and being tolerant of other people's opinions, even if in the end, or maybe especially if in the end you don't agree with them, then what kind of human beings are we? You know, the temple was not even just for Jews. There were certain places within the temple compound that non-Jews could go as well. Judaism is not a religion just for a narrow way of thinking. It is a universal religion. And we believe that God loves everybody, and God loves everyone with all our differences. He did not create a world, a gray world, of everybody believing the same thing. What makes the world such an exciting and sometimes crazy and scary place is that we do all have differences of ideas, and we need to be able to listen to the other people's ideas and respect them, even while disagreeing, but disagreeing in a good way and in a respectful way, both in our personal relationships, right? If you're you're not going to agree, even if you're totally in love with the person with whom you're married, you're not always going to agree. You're still two different people, okay? For many of us, our children have been our biggest educators because they don't come out cookie cutter. I don't know, maybe for you guys, but my 7, absolutely no way. And they have been my greatest teachers because I love them, because I want to understand why they think the way they do, why they're doing certain things that they do. I listen to them. I listen to them, and I may still at the end disagree. But if I'm not going to be a part of that conversation with them, they're not going to have any respect for the way that I think either. And I think we need to do this on a larger level. I think that's what the temple, which we are not going to be able to go to today because it was destroyed, and now it's being even destroyed in people's memories, like there wasn't any, right? And we have to be so careful about that as well. But that's so much what that symbolized. Also a place of philosophy, of exchange of ideas, of a vibrancy and a dynamism that we need to maintain, all right? And that's a very big part of Judaism. Israel, the struggle with God. But the struggle means the debate and the questions, and not just saying all the time, like, we're right and that's the way it is. So we are called now to a time where we have very difficult decisions that we have to make, and none of us are going to be completely happy with anything that we do. But decisions we must make. But first we have to ask the questions and try and get the answers and be uncomfortable. Most of us don't like being uncomfortable, all right? Lots of us are uncomfortable now all the time because there's just nothing, a lot, or not nothing, but not a lot that's making us feel good about a lot of the things going on in the world. But if you don't take part in the conversation, if you don't listen to the other side, and then also try and have the other side understand why you feel a certain way, then you're just letting other people decide. And that's not what Judaism is. That's not what faith is. And, you know, in terms of like the Jewish vote, just to get back to that, in America, I think, and something that makes me very proud, even though I will not agree with many of the standards and the ideas that other Jews have in America, for me, going into the voting booth, my big concern is not how the candidate feels about pro-choice. That is not like on my list even of why I would vote for somebody or not. All right. So there's a lot of differences there. But one thing that I am very proud of is the getting involved and of the caring and of the never ending hope that individuals can make a difference, that we can influence. And that's why Jews love living in democracies, because for so much of our history, we didn't live in places that allowed us to express ourselves, that allowed us to have the freedoms to be who we wanted to be. It's something that we treasure greatly. And that's why I know that there is such a patriotism among American Jewry for the United States, because we don't take for granted those freedoms. And definitely here in Israel, we live in a Middle East where this is the only democracy. And that means a tremendous amount to us. And that's why, with all our differences of opinion here in Israel also, and sometimes I think what divides us here in Israel makes it child's play what's going on in the United States, because we have tremendous existential issues here as well. Okay, if you believe that you should be giving up land to somebody who's then going to use it as a base for terror and for war, that can become an existential issue. But with all that, we learn to dialogue. We have to learn to respect the other. And on a holiday like Sukkot, you go around Israel and you see everybody out, the families out in the national parks, in their sukkah, celebrating the holiday in whatever way it means to us. And we can do that because it's a national holiday, because here we're home, because here we finally came home. After a long time, there will always be Jews here, but as in terms of sovereignty and in terms of being able to decide, we can finally do that here in Israel. And let's none of us, if you're listening around the world, and I know that I have some listeners who do not live in democracies, who do not live in places where they have the choice. So I pray for you that wherever you're living, one day you'll have the luxury of choosing between two candidates, even if you're not crazy about either of them. Because within the choice is in itself a blessing, that we have that ability to make those choices, flawed and difficult as they may be. And let's never forget that, okay? That freedom, with all the contradictions and all the difficulties, that kind of freedom is so treasured by the Jewish people and everywhere that we are. And so I just want to, from the heart of Jerusalem, first of all, I want to thank Ben and Tabitha and everybody here at the Land of Israel Network for giving me the ability to come and share my thoughts and decide whom to interview and give you these different ideas, even if, or maybe especially if, they make you uncomfortable. Never stop thinking, people. Never stop thinking, dreaming, praying, and trying to make things better, starting with ourselves and moving on eventually to the surroundings around us and maybe even the world. It starts from that. So a wonderful Chag Sameach, a happy Sukkot holiday to all of us who celebrate Sukkot. I probably will not be broadcasting during the holiday, so I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Bless all of you. Thank you so much for listening. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation from Jerusalem. Goodbye, everybody, for now. This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. They belonged to the Mizrahi movement way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.